Michael Nicholson, real nine. So your next war, Michael, where was that?
Israel. Yom Kippur, which followed quickly after by the Lebanon. I think Yom Kippur was my fifth war. And again, a bit like the Six-Day War, it was a very short war. It lasted 17 days. I remember the day it started because I was out sailing in the Solent with an old ITN buddy, Geoffrey Archer. The ITN Geoffrey Archer, not the scoundrel Geoffrey Archer. And we were kind of breezing along, and I think it must have been Geoffrey, because I seldom listen to the radio when I'm sailing, but he turned the radio on, and we heard on the 1 o'clock news that the Egyptians had crossed the Suez Canal into Israel, and the war had begun. And so we were desperate to get back to shore. It took us a long time because there was no wind, but that afternoon, I came straight home, went straight off to the airport, where I was met by David Phillips, our producer, and Jerry Seymour, who became the best-selling novelist, but he was an ITN reporter then. And the idea, of course, was to get to Tel Aviv as quickly as we could. Now, as in most wars, as soon as the war begins, of course, the airport closes down. So we had to wait at London Airport from that Saturday afternoon until the Sunday, when Tel Aviv Airport opened and had to open because they were waiting for the mass movement of Jews from abroad. You know, that if you are a Jew and you have dual nationality, you are obliged to come to Israel's help in a time of war. And so London Airport was crowded with young Jewish boys and girls of all nationalities who were queuing up to get the flight into Tel Aviv. And as luck would have it, and as ITN's luck was always pretty infallible in those days, we queued up with the soldiers, and whether they thought we were soldiers or not, I have no idea, because we weren't carrying television equipment. We had crews already in the Middle East. We got on board the flight, and I remember that flight very well, because here were, you close your eyes and you can hear an Australian accent, a Cockney accent, a Brummy accent, an American accent, a French accent. All these were international Jews, young men and women going off to fight for their country. It was quite astonishing. And it was decided on the plane between Jerry, David and myself that as soon as we landed, we would be met by our crews. One was a resident Israeli cameraman, and another was a UPI cameraman who was an agency cameraman. And they were seconded to us. As soon as we landed, we would split forces, and Jerry would go up to the Golan in the north where the Syrians were attacking, and I would go south into the Sinai Desert where the Egyptians were advancing. If you remember, just to go back historically, President Sadat of Egypt was not a warmonger. I mean, he really was a man of peace, and had been trying to broker a permanent peace settlement between the Arab nations surrounding Israel and Israel. And he was hoping that the Americans would be the honest broker. The Americans, for some reason, which, I can't remember the reason now, obviously it's been discovered since, but at the time I didn't understand why they were not prepared to broker a peace, but they weren't. And so Sadat had a council of Arab chiefs, and it was decided, and it was Sadat's idea, that if they could attack Israel as a combined force on all fronts, not just from the Western Front from Israel, from Egypt, or not just from the Northern Front from Syria, or from Jordan on the east, but as a concerted attack. Israel would have so many fronts to fight on that there was no way that they could do what they did in a six-day war and accomplish an easy victory. It wasn't Sadat's idea, as I understand it, to win the war. They didn't think they could. But if they could establish a quick invasion, get their forces into Israel, they were in a very strong position then to negotiate a peace. And for the first time, they would have Israel's arm twisted behind its back to agree to a peace, and that the superpowers, in order to the superpowers, Russia and America and Britain to a lesser extent, and France, would be obliged to come in and sort it out politically. And that's what Sadat had in mind. He didn't expect to win the war, but he hoped that he would win it long enough for a peace to be brokered by the superpowers. So anyway, coming back to the action, Jerry motored north up to Galilee and into the Golan where the Syrians were attacking, and I jumped into Brian Carwitz's car. He had a huge American car, big open car. Which of course was a pretty obvious target for the Arabs to see an American car driving through Gaza and down towards the Sinai. As I think I wrote in my book, it was an obvious target for young boys' stones, old women's ridicule, and old men's spittle. But anyway, we motored, and it was a long drive. I mean, to go from Tel Aviv even into the Sinai, you're talking about 5-6 hours, and actually to start driving down towards the canal, I mean, it's about 11 hours. And Brian and I were, you know, expecting to see the advance guard of the Egyptian army coming towards us. And we searched everywhere. It really was a needle in a haystack. Vast expanse of desert, you know, leading east and south. We saw nothing. And I was quite despairing because, you know, I knew that, I mean, the Golan is not so far. You can get into the Golan Heights in 2 or 3 hours from Tel Aviv. And knowing Jerry's luck, because he was a lucky man too, and knowing his expertise and determination, you know, there was never a more determined person than Jerry Seymour. I always used to say that the only two people I feared in my job was Martin Bell of the BBC and Jerry Seymour of ITN. And he was on my side. I knew that Jerry would get the story, and I, you know, I thought, damn it, trust me to get the short straw. Here am I chasing Egyptians in the desert, and Jerry's going to have the great scoop of the day. And we were just about to turn back because the one thing we didn't want to be was you know, spend a night in the desert in an open car, freezing cold in the desert at night. In between two armies who could, you know, start shelling each other at any moment. So we decided to turn back. But then just as we did this kind of wide circle in the sand to go back to Tel Aviv, we saw in the distance this dust cloud, sand cloud. And when you're in the desert and you see that rising sand, it can only mean one of two things. Either it's a sandstorm or it's vehicles. And we just prayed to God that it was vehicles, and sure enough, as they came closer, we could see this huge convoy coming towards us. And as they got closer, I mean, Brian could see through his lens, and he was screaming excitedly. You know, there were Centurion tanks, there were armored personnel carriers, there were troop carriers, there were lorries, there were guns. I mean, it was a massive, massive convoy, howitzers, all moving through the desert. You know, you can picture, you can imagine the sight of it. It was mind-blowing. And, I mean, to my mind, it brought back, you know, the wartime pictures, Second World Wartime pictures of the great armored convoys going through the North African desert. So, of course, as they came closer, Brian started filming and got it from every angle, and I could see the tail end of it coming up, so I jumped in front of the camera and started to shout excitedly about what I was seeing and what it meant, and, you know, it's all off the cuff. But even then, I think I was did have a talent to kind of quickly invent words when it was needed. And as I started to kind of run out of words, Brian kind of did that across his throat, cut his throat to say, right, that's enough, let's go. We jumped in the car and off we went, absolutely delirious. Because here we had the first evidence, on the second day, evidence that here were the Israelis moving off to meet the Egyptians. This was the counterattack. Absolutely marvelous. We couldn't have been happier, singing songs and then suddenly as we passed the kilometer 280, which was 280 to Tel Aviv, the sign in the desert, kilometer 280, we thought, oh, wow, 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 what are we singing about? There's no way we'll get back to Tel Aviv in time for the satellite feed to London for news at 10 that night, you know. But I think, again, as I remember writing, one should never underestimate the tenacity of cameramen when their film is at risk, or even the quick-footedness and the sleight of hand at film editors when they're desperate to meet a satellite time. And the film has rushed through the bath at Herzliya, the processing bath, and the film editor, John Harwood, cut the film so fast, and he said to me afterwards that I didn't know where your camera ended, but as soon as I heard you stutter, I cut it. And he rushed it into the satellite feed area, and it got through before the bird came, before the satellite closed. So that night, News at 10 had a report from the two fronts, from Jerry in the Golan and from me in the Sinai. It was a world scoop. It was absolutely amazing. And I didn't know about this because I went dejectedly back to the hotel, absolutely exhausted, thinking that, you know, well, we'll show it tomorrow, but what a damn shame, you know, we didn't see it. And the phone rang, and it was London, delirious. So that's how the war began for me. And it was, I must say, a pretty exciting time, and an exciting place to be.
It seems quite, I'm sure people wonder, you know, when they listen to this, or when they watch the news even, you know, in a situation like that, could you just go off in a car like that, in the middle of a war, between two armies? Did you have to get accreditation, permission?
No, we did later, of course, but at that time, I mean, the whole of Tel Aviv was in a state of total chaos and panic, virtual hysteria. You know, Jerusalem is, as you know, is split into two. So in Jerusalem, when we were there some days later, you've got the Jewish part of Jerusalem absolutely silent and, you know, desperate, and the Arab part of Jerusalem festive and joyful because of what was happening. And if you know, it was called Yom Kippur because 6 October is the Jewish day of atonement. It's a day of rest. It's also an Arab celebration. Battle of Badr. And it's halfway through Ramadan. So in a way, it's an Arab holiday too, but most especially a Jewish one, because on that day, you know, it's simply rest and prayers. And the moment that the Israelis realized that something was going terribly wrong was when aircraft flew very low over Tel Aviv, and people knew that no machines were ever used on Yom Kippur. So when they saw aircraft in the air, that was their first signal that something was up. And of course, then they tuned into the news and heard that Golda Meir, Prime Minister, had called all her war council together, pulled them off their farms and kibbutzes, and, you know, they're all on on holiday, and in they came to prepare for war. So the whole of Israel was in such a state that the last thing that people were worried about at that time was crediting the press. I mean, there weren't any press. We were the first press in, Jerry and I and David. That was ITN's greatest scoop, having smuggled ourselves. I think it was. I think it's the right word to use, smuggle, because I think they did assume that we were part of a military force going in. Anyway, once we'd arrived, our first priority was to get to the fighting. It was only later, when the Israelis started to organise themselves, that they started to, and all the other world's press came rushing in. We were the first in. BBC didn't turn up for another couple of days. They couldn't get in. But it's only when the massive of the world's press came in that they started to accredit us. But no, it is quite normal in panic situations like that simply to ignore all officialdom, bypass it as you can, jump into the nearest car and go and find the war. Then that's what we did, and we did it very successfully.
Yeah. How close were you to this convoy, interposed between the armies? Although the Egyptians would have been way off.
Oh, the Egyptians were good 50, 60 miles away at that time.
Yes, but the Israelis, when you were doing your filming,
I was
right in
there. Oh, I could have touched them. Oh, yes, we were right on their path. I mean, we were right close up, close enough to see guys putting their thumbs up and cheering. No, we were right there, right with it. And if we hadn't been, we'd have driven to it, because, drive anywhere in the desert, virtually.
Yes. The other question I was going to ask, did you get any idea at this stage whether the Israelis were taken totally by surprise at that attack?
They were taken by surprise, yes. They weren't totally surprised, because their own intelligence had warned them. And Israeli intelligence then, not pretty good now, but then it was 100% Mossad and the military intelligence. They had been told that the Syrians were massing armor on the northern border. They were told that there had been movement of Jordanian troops on the other side of the Jordan, and their own patrols along the Nile, west of the Barlev line, along the Nile itself, had warned them that they'd heard a lot of machinery on the other side, and that there were lights, arc lights, at night. Now, just to explain to you, you can't see straight across the Nile into Egypt. There are sand dunes which protect people on the other side. You can't see what's going on the other side. It was that protection. Now, nowadays, they couldn't do that, because they'd have high-fly surveillance planes. They didn't have it then. They would have had satellite pictures of movement. They didn't have it then. But they knew there was something going on, and for that reason, I mean, General Dayan, who was the army commander, was warning Golda Meir that there was movement on the Arab side, military maneuvers, massing of armor. So they were, the Israelis weren't unprepared. They'd been in a state of second alert for some time. But it was the day that surprised them. Had they not been so prepared, they could not have reacted so quickly. And they did react, of course, very, very quickly indeed. Okay, shall I carry on?
Yes. You went back to the desert, did you?
We went back to the desert. I as I said, I'd taken the short straw, and by that time an ITN crew had come out, John Lane and Hugh Thompson, and we'd take it in turns. We'd leave the Dan Hotel in Tel Aviv at about 4 in the morning, and then we would take it in turns, an hour's driving each. I bought an alarm clock so that we made certain that it was... Because once you're behind the wheel, you think, oh, I'm okay, I can keep. But, one of the things driving in the desert at night, you've got no real markers, and you can get very bored and fall asleep, and that's the last thing you wanted to do, end up in a crash. That was to come later. So we took it in turns, and it was a 7-8 hour drive, and then we'd give ourselves a couple of hours of filming, and then all the way back to get our film on air. Didn't always happen that way, of course. There was always roadblocks, there were diversion, military diversions. I remember on one occasion, I think by this time, yeah, that's right, after about a week of this, we just couldn't keep it up. I mean, it was just too much for us. It was physically just too much. So we swapped, and Jerry started to do the Sinai, and I started to do the Golan, which was much nicer. And I remember on one occasion we were filming this huge convoy winding up beyond Galilee up the Golan Heights to start putting in position gun batteries to start hitting the Syrians, and we were strafed by Syrian jets, and we ran for cover under a huge lorry, massive great lorry. Which we thought would give us excellent cover, and just beyond the other side of the road, 100 yards away, there was a soldier waving excitedly at us, and we just ignored him, thinking he was telling us to get out. In fact, we were actually wearing army tunics, just the top, to try and make out that we were, you know, part of the army. We were discovered later and kicked out, but we ignored this guy until he came running over us, you know, ignoring all the strafing that was going on. And he said, "Look, you can stay here if you like, but I'm the driver of this lorry, and it's full of high explosives." So we scarpered, got out of there fast. On another occasion, we were driving with a second crew, Chris Folds and Johnny Saltini, in a big Volvo, going up just beyond Nazareth, going towards Galilee. And Johnny was driving, and all of a sudden, there was an enormous roar. And this huge shadow kind of came over the car. It was, you know, like being attacked by a locomotive. And the next thing we knew, Johnny had kind of driven off the road, taken so much by surprise, it had come off the road, tried to get it back on again, and we somersaulted. We're doing about 80, 90 miles an hour. And we somersaulted three times, according to an eyewitness, and we landed on our roof. Miraculously, Johnny and Chris were only slightly cut and managed to get out, but I was trapped in the back seat and came to. I lost consciousness, came to, and simply couldn't move. They had to cut me out. And I could feel things dribbling down my head and neck, and I thought, oh, I'm bleeding, but it turned out to be petrol. And from then on, I had to wear a neck. I was taken off to hospital with whiplash injuries and a few cuts and bruises. And, you know, treated for concussion. And I had to wear a neck brace, and which I was rather proud to do, you know, a war reporter wearing a neck brace, the Medal of the War, you know, I felt very proud. But my editor, Nigel Ryan, was getting hate mail from viewers, lots of complaints, how dare you, you know, keep this poor man in the war that he's now that he's been injured. But I was determined not to come home, even though they'd ordered me home. I was determined not to. So Nigel Ryan eventually sent me a cable, which I seem to remember read, "Either neck brace comes off the screen or you do." So every time I wanted to do a piece to camera or anything like that, I had to take this neck brace off. And as I had the habit of doing, you know, unexpected things like jumping onto tanks and interviewing the tank commander, or running alongside troops and interviewing them, you know, having to take the neck brace off every time rather reduced the drama of the event. So anyway, I kept out there, and within a week or so, the neck brace came off. And then, as I seem to remember writing at the time, you know, when you're in war, you you suffer from a paranoia sometimes. But when it's indiscriminate shelling, you can somehow imagine that they're not aiming for you. But having been attacked by this Syrian MiG, which is what this great shadow was, strafing us, and then having recovered from the injury, we were then attacked a second time within 10 days by another Syrian aircraft as we were going driving towards Kenetra. And we actually saw him coming this time, and he was actually firing rockets at us. Why they bothered, I mean, it was a bright blue, maybe they thought we were United Nations. Maybe that was the explanation, being in a blue car. But we stopped the car and jumped out, and the rockets landed only 50, 60 yards ahead of us. And then, but David As I jumped into the ditch, David jumped on top of me and straight onto my neck. So on came the neck brace again for a fortnight. So you know, to be attacked once by a Syrian MiG is bad luck. And to be attacked twice in a fortnight is very bad luck.
You must have taken that rather personally.
I did, yes. Yeah. What have I ever done to Syria? I thought that they should have it in for me.
Into the Golan area, how far had the battle progressed at that stage? You know, I'm wondering what the sort of scene you witnessed. Was there a lot of debris and
casualties
about?
No, because at that point, it never came to hand-to-hand fighting, you see. It never came to close combat. It was all artillery and air warfare. I remember one occasion going up in the Golan and filming this astonishing scene of these huge guns, the 155mm guns, the biggest gun that there is. Long range, can you know hit 20 miles, maybe more, at least 20 miles away. And we filmed this amazing scene of the sun setting, this huge gun pounding Damascus, or at least in the direction of Damascus. All these Israelis stripped to their waist, you know, sweating. There's piles of brass shell cases, and this great gun off. We interviewed the lieutenant. I remember him. I said, "How many shells have you fired in this week?" He said, "Oh," he said, "over 400, nearly 500 shells." He said, "But that probably means 4,000 dead Syrians." And as we were leaving, he turned to me, and he was a very handsome guy, you know, black hair, broad grin, this gold chain with the Star of David on a hairy chest, and this huge gun in the background, and as I say, the brass shows. And he said, "Do you have any cigarettes?" "I don't smoke," but John threw him a packet of cigarettes, and he caught it, and he said to the camera, "Ah, Benson." And I thought, we've just lost ourselves $1 million advert, and it would have been absolutely, if we'd only filmed that, we could have retired on it. I said artillery, but also air warfare. And I think one of the lasting images I have of that war was the war in the air. You'd see the Israeli phantoms, mirages flying high, and then you'd see this vapor trail, rocket trail of a missile being fired at them, and you'd see the aircraft, you know, careering, spiraling in the sky, trying to avoid the, because they could see them coming, and the secret, as I was told, was by pilots that you had to gauge that it was close enough. Then you did a sudden turn, and it would just overshoot. Because if you left it too late, it went straight up your tailpipe. And sometimes we would see these, if they were high, just these trails, you know, the vapor trails of the aircraft twisting and turning, being followed by the heat-seeking missile. And sometimes you'd see the aircraft go one way, and the trail of the missile go off and explode harmlessly. Or sometimes you'd see a big explosion, and you knew the aircraft had gone. It was an amazing sight. Shan't ever forget that.
Did you see many casualties in either area? I suppose as you went into the desert, the front line was getting further away.
Further away. It was beyond the Barlev line, of course, in the last few days. In the last week, it was beyond the Barlev line. I think that's. I suppose the worst casualties we saw was it was a huge Syrian convoy coming from Sasa to Kenetra on that road, and a very large convoy, mostly of troops, and the Israelis had planned this terrible ambush from the air.